Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Thursday, March 7th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Teresa Whitaker and Dorothy Hockenberg. And here's our first story. Family evicted from trailer. Notice comes nearly 2 months after sewage overflow. And this is an article by Tom Lowy. Jennifer Mikla and her family didn't live in their home for 51 days. The 37-year-old mother of three and her boyfriend, Matt Jensen, couldn't move back into their $1,080 a month manufactured home in Davenport's Silver Creek Mobile Home Park because the city condemned it February 12th. That action came almost a month after every drain in the home overflowed with sewage, spilling human waste and sodden shreds of toilet paper all over the floors. The owner of the property, a Denver-based corporation called Yes Communities, at first refused to clean the property. Mikla, Jensen, and the children lived in hotels until their money ran out. That's when they called the city, and the inspectors closed the property on February 12th. Now the city says the property is fit for people to live in, but Mikla and Jensen say the house has not been properly sanitized. To make matters worse, they were served an eviction notice Monday. The notice says they owe rent for the months of February and March, even though they did not occupy the home from January 14th to March 4th. Silver Creek's management team changed the locks to the home in February after Mikla complained to the city, she said. Mikla and Jensen have not been given keys to the home, and even though the city says they can live there, and Yes Communities is charging them rent, they have to ask management to open the door for them when they enter and lock the home when they leave. Who is the city helping? Mikla and Jensen were forced to return to their home this week. When they did, they found dried shreds of toilet paper in the areas where cabinets met the floors. They say their bathrooms are infested by forid flies. Forid flies are called coffin flies because they breed in decaying moist matter. They typically consume organic matter found around drains and sewage pipes. We called the city in the first place to help us because we had sewage backed up in our home and no one from Yes Communities would help us, Mikla said. We haven't been able to get into the home, and when we do, we find that nothing has been moved, nothing was cleaned under. Yes had at least three companies in here to clean, and nothing besides the floors were sanitized. They cleaned the toilets, which means they wiped them down. They did not clean under anything. The fact we are infested with flies proves the organic matter has not been removed. And Jensen says when a company attempted to clean the air ducts, dust was blown all over the home. We have floor ducts, and the sewage got into them, Jensen said. When the ducts were supposedly clean, they just blew all the dust, including the dried sewage, all over our home. The city says our home is fit and clean. We came back, and there was dried toilet paper stuck between the bottom of the cabinets and the floor. It was not a thorough cleaning. Who is the city helping? Nicole Gleason is Davenport's assistant city administrator and public works director. She said Silver Creek's management showed it had the work done to clean Mikla's home. In an email, she wrote, "The city's standard to clear any substandard certification is proof that work has been completed by a certified contractor of restoration work. In this case, the city inspected on February 27th and found no evidence of sewage. The proof of work being completed was forwarded to the city on March 4th. This is what prompted the removal of the substandard certification. Additionally, the city visited the site again March 4th and required a few minor additional items be sanitized, which was done while the city was on site. Gleason said Silver Creek was not fined because Yes Communities has met all established deadlines for completing the work. As for any infrastructure issues raised by sewage backing into Mikla's home, Gleason said responsibility for the backup falls on Silver Creek and Yes Communities. The cause of the sewer backing up would only require city intervention if it was due to the city's sewer line. It was determined that the backup was all internal to the mobile home park. Therefore, a root cause was not determined, Gleason wrote. It is not within the city's purview to manage the root cause. It is purely to ensure that the landlord performs the restoration and provides certification that the restoration has been completed. Jensen said he feels like the city protected Yes Communities while he and his family were left to just figure things out. Do you know how we survived? We survived because strangers helped us. That's the only reason we are here, he said. People we didn't even know came forward and offered us help. Private citizens. It wasn't the city. It wasn't Silver Creek or Yes Communities. The sewage backing up into our home was not our fault. We didn't do anything wrong. We were not negligent. If it wasn't for strangers coming forward, I don't know where we would be. Mikla and Jensen were at their financial end by February 12th when the city officially closed their home. They had paid January rent, but they had paid for hotels from the time they vacated on January 14th to February 12th. They now face a demand for $2,213 from Yes Communities for unpaid rent. A man from Olene helped us, Mikla said. He paid for us to stay in a hotel, and he helped us, took us to dinner. That same man is helping Mikla and Jensen find another home. He has asked to remain anonymous. Davenport City Council member Miso, who represents the 7th Ward, gave the family a place to stay at her bed and breakfast. She made that decision after Mikla spoke at the February 28th City Council meeting. Jennifer Mikla spoke, and it was terrible to hear, Lynch said. So of course I did what I could to help. It wasn't a hard decision. I had the resources and could help, so I did. Jensen said a number of the aldermen stepped up after that meeting and pledged support. Jade Burkholder, 4th Ward, Tim Dunn, 2nd Ward, Tim Kelly, 5th Ward, and Jasmine Newton at large. Mikla said Kelly and Dunn took the time to visit their home. That individual care contrasts with how Mikla feels the city has treated the family. I feel like the city doesn't really want to hear about problems. I'm not sure, but I feel like the city really isn't interested in hearing from its citizens, she said. Mikla said she feels like the city never really advocated for her family. The city has basically dismissed their standards, stating they have no control over a rental company who privately owns the land. So we as tenants are stuck standing our ground to ensure the safety and health of the tenants after us because no one else is, Mikla said. I can accept any liabilities that come from it because I know I'm doing the right thing and it's teaching my children to do the same.
Okay, now we go to the next item with timeless tickets. Davenport held first Rockfest in 1973. This is by Gannon Hannevold. REO Speedwagon Blue Oyster Cult headlined. 13 arrests, an alderman in handcuffs, several people treated for drug poisoning. In Davenport in 1973, it was a crazy 4th of July. The occasion? The city's first real Rockfest, the Mississippi Valley Music Fair hosted on the Davenport Riverfront on July 4, 1973. It was an all-day affair with music starting at 10 a.m. and going on until 7:30 p.m. The headlining bands were REO Speedwagon and Blue Oyster Cult, with acts like Detroit, Siegel and Shawl, Slaughterhouse, Catfish and Crystal, and Truth further down the lineup. The show came just days after a planned festival with mostly the same lineup in Muscatine that had to be canceled. The 3,000 folks with tickets to that event had their tickets honored in Davenport. Early estimates for attendance ranged greatly from 3,000 to 10,000, all the way up to 25,000. The final estimation, according to a Times Democrat story published a day after the festival, was around 5,000 on the Davenport levee to see the rock show. It was truly a miniature Woodstock in our backyard, complete with chaos and iconic rock and roll. At the time, REO Speedwagon was more of a local buzz than the national stars they'd end up being. The band was founded and based in Champaign, Illinois, by the summer of 1973. They had just released two records, neither of which garnered much national attention. They didn't truly break through until 4 years later with their first entry in the Billboard Hot 100, Riding the Storm Out. Throughout the 80s, they charted 17 more songs and revisited the Quad Cities many times in the process. Blue Oyster Cult, on the other hand, was already beginning their upward trajectory. They garnered some buzz with their 1972 single, Cities on Flame with Rock and Roll, and their 1973 full-length sophomore album, Tyranny and the Mutation, which cracked the Billboard 200. 3 years later, devout listeners everywhere feared the Reaper. Davenport's On Flame with Rock and Roll. The festival itself was the subject of speculation and controversy in the lead-up. The Moline Dispatch reported that initial plans were for a three-day festival with 50 bands. Even 2 weeks before it happened, city attorneys described its viability as up in the air. But still, the show went on. The festival organizers picked the Davenport Levee as their venue as a last resort, first looking for spots in rural eastern Iowa, according to recap stories published in the Times-Democrat. The whole thing was thrown together in just 6 days, with the help from across the region. Officers with crowd control experience were called in from Chicago. Organizers conceded that there would likely be drug use in the crowd. On site, there would be medical personnel and a children's daycare. Tickets sold for just $5. On the day of the long-awaited and expectedly chaotic festival, a morning rain made the entire festival grounds extremely muddy. Some festival goers weren't satisfied with the terrain. They didn't pick a very good spot, a 19-year-old from Clinton told the Times-Democrat. Others weren't satisfied at all. By the middle of the day, the temperature hit 85 degrees. It could have been better, a better place with more shade, better groups, a 16-year-old from Davenport said. But still, most of the estimated 5,000 in the crowd managed to have a great time. Faces of all shapes, adornments, and colors smiled easily. Voices were gentle and joyful. Many people spent the day under makeshift sun shelters, sipping cold beer or wine, chatting with friends, and listening to the music, wrote the Times-Democrat. The closer people were to the stage, the more the music affected them, until at least they were drawn into the hurricane of sound and beat and seemed to become a part of it. Riding the storm out. Others in the crowd had too great of a time. In the wake of the show were 7 drug-related arrests and 13 arrests total. State agents said that around 450 capsules of what they suspected was LSD were seized at the festival. A Davenport alderman was arrested for trespassing after getting too close to the fenced exterior, trying to see if there was anything going on that the city wouldn't permit. When asked how he felt about the way he was treated, the alderman, Powell Owens of Davenport, told the Times-Democrat, "If the citizens of our town are treated like this, then I think we're in bad shape." After the show, a sea of trash littered the levee. Bottles and plastic were everywhere, according to the Times-Democrat recap. The show's promoters attempted to announce their plans over the speakers to distribute garbage bags to attendees, but they couldn't get the message out. Somebody had already turned off the power and driven off with the wires. The Mississippi Valley Music Fair never returned to the Quad Cities. But a different rock and roll festival did come back to the riverfront at the end of the decade, Mississippi River Jam, hosted in 1978 and 1979, with bands like AC/DC, Journey, Van Halen, and Heart on the Hill. In 1980, another fest appeared called Isle of Rock, which featured Sammy Hagar and a return of REO Speedwagon, then at the precipice of their peak. This story is part of a series called Timeless Tickets, where we're aiming to find the most notable concert in the Quad Cities every year from 1960 to today. Do you have a story or photo to share from an iconic local show? Send it to entertainment reporter Gannon and Hannevold at gannevold@qctimes.com.
Local woman wants sentence reconsidered. This is by Anthony Watt. A woman accused of hiding her son's death for months has asked a judge to reconsider her sentence. In July, police found Zion Staples' body in a garbage can in the garage of his Rock Island home, according to authorities. Investigators think the 10-year-old died sometime in December of 2022 when a gun he was playing with went off. Authorities believe his death was an accident. Authorities do not think Sushi Staples, now 38, was home when her son died, but think she concealed the boy's death once she learned of it. In February, Judge Frank Furr sentenced Staples to 2 years in an Illinois prison, followed by 6 months of mandatory supervised release on account of endangering a child. Staples has pleaded guilty to the count as part of an agreement with the Rock Island County State's Attorney's Office. On February 20th, Staples submitted a handwritten letter that included a request for paperwork to ask for a reconsideration of her sentence. The letter was filed in the Rock Island County Clerk's Office on February 22nd. "I have been in Rock Island County Jail for 7 months," she wrote in a later document supporting her motion to reconsider. "I have learned my lesson, and I would just like to get back to doing what I have to do to regain custody of my children and being a productive citizen of society." Instead of a prison sentence or commitment to a mental health facility, she is requesting a deferred judgment, mental health court, and probation. She wrote that she is a first-time felon who has never been to prison before. Her arguments also include that incarceration will prevent her from gainful employment and providing housing for her other children, according to court documents. For the sentence she received in February, Staples got credit for the time she served in the Rock Island County Jail in relation to the case, court records state. Staples also qualified for day-for-day credit on her prison term, which could further reduce her actual time incarcerated. Rock Island County Public Defender Hanny Corey filed the motion to reconsider on Staples' behalf. In the February 20th letter, Staples also said she wanted paperwork for a motion to withdraw her plea and to pursue a claim of ineffective assistance by counsel. Corey filed a motion to withdraw a plea on February 28th. In it, he referenced Staples' letter. "It is reasonable to conclude that the defendant wishes to withdraw her plea of guilty and believes she has a basis to do so," the motion to withdraw plea states. On February 23rd, Corey filed a motion to withdraw as Staples' attorney. That document also referenced Staples' letter. Earlier in her case, William Wolfe, a private attorney, represented her but withdrew in November. He argued he had discovered a conflict of interest. Corey's office has represented her since, including at her sentencing. Corey was still appearing on behalf of Staples as of March 1st. A hearing to address the claim of ineffective counsel has been scheduled for April 23rd.
Moline native hired as Mercado director by Gretchen Teske. Mercado on 5th is gearing up to reopen in May with a new leader at the helm. Frances Williams, a Moline native who spent the last 24 years in Denver, was hired in January as Mercado's new executive director, a news release from the organization said. She joins the nonprofit as it prepares for its 8th season of Friday night outdoor markets on 5th Avenue in downtown Moline. "We could not have found a better person for Mercado on 5th at this stage," said Maria Ontiveros, who co-founded the organization with her late grandfather, Bob Ontiveros, founder of Group O. "Not only will Frances add value to our network of small and minority-owned businesses, she has already demonstrated incredible leadership for our team in her first few weeks. Since Mercado launched in 2016, has worked with its community partners, including Black Hawk College and the Illinois Small Business Development Center at Western Illinois University Quad Cities, to help start more than 60 new businesses, most of which are minority-owned. Williams' work experience includes 3.5 years with Mi Casa Resource Center, one of the largest and oldest Latino-serving organizations in the state of Colorado, according to the release. While at Mi Casa and serving as senior director of Pathways, she managed a team of more than 25 employees. Quote, "My passion is to assist other entrepreneurs in launching their own formalized businesses that can not only build wealth and prosperity for themselves, but also future generations. Coming back to the Quad Cities and being able to continue that mission through Mercado is a blessing," Williams said. Of Colombian descent and fluent in Spanish, Frances spent 4 years prior to COVID expanding her financial planning services to families in the majority of Latin American countries. She has also started 3 businesses of her own. Becoming a new steward to the mission of Mercado is something I am quite excited and honored to continue, Williams said. Having places where the minority entrepreneurs can get education, support, and celebration of who they are and where they are in their journey is key to economic growth and prosperity. Williams is a graduate of Seton Catholic School, Alleman High School, and studied international business, finance and business administration at Northern Illinois University, Black Hawk College, and St. Mary's College. She is an avid global traveler and enjoys a variety of outdoor activities, is very family-oriented, and loves being in the company of her many Midwestern cousins.
Okay, I've got 2 short articles here I'm going to read. First one, One Person Hospitalized After Fire by Sarah Watson. One person was hospitalized after a home fire in Moline in the early hours of Wednesday morning. The Moline Fire Department responded to the fire at 3:56 a.m. Wednesday at a small single-family home in the 2400 block of 32nd Avenue, according to a news release. Firefighters arrived in 7 minutes and reported smoke and fire coming from the rear of the home. Bystanders at the scene told firefighters they had smelled smoke and noticed the home was on fire and were unsure if anyone was inside the home. One person was rescued from inside the home and taken to an ambulance, according to the news release. Paramedics performed life-saving care and transported the person to the hospital. Firefighters brought the fire under control in about 30 minutes, according to the news release, and stayed on scene for 2 hours looking for hidden areas still burning. The fire department said it was unsure if the home had working smoke detectors. The initial Moline fire response included 17 on-duty personnel, 3 engine companies, 1 aerial unit, a command vehicle, and 2 ambulances. The fire is under investigation. Further assistance was provided by East Moline, Rock Island, and Arsenal fire departments. Moline's second alarmers and Mid-American Energy also assisted. And Farmers Markets Closing by Grace Kennicott. Quad Cities Growers Market Farmers Markets are permanently closing. The announcement was made Wednesday morning on the market's Facebook page. It's with a heavy heart that we announce that we are closing the market permanently at both locations, the post said. Unfortunately, we have not been able to have the number of vendors needed to sustain the market. Some of our vendors will be attending other events or markets. The market typically opened in May or June and closed at the end of October. Based on previous reporting, last year's market at Skate City opened in early May and held on Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to noon. The Moline Market was held at South Park and opened in early June last year. It was held on Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. The market faced difficulties last year as growers struggled with the lack of rain, leading to the South Park Market being canceled multiple times and opening later in the season, according to the Facebook page. The market thanked its loyal customers over the years and urged people to check out the business pages to locate where vendors will continue to be at and when. In a follow-up post, the page said several individual vendors were still planning to set up on Wednesdays and Saturdays at the East Moline location at Skate City.
Teen killed in shooting identified by Tom Lowy and Gretchen Teske. The victim in Monday's shooting has been identified as 16-year-old Desai L. Bailey. Bailey died at a hospital Monday night after suffering from a gunshot wound. Just before 10 p.m. on Monday, March 4th, Davenport Police, Fire, and EMS responded to a home in the 1800 block of Grand Avenue for a report of a gunshot victim. Officers found Bailey inside the home with an apparent gunshot wound. She was transported to a local hospital where she later died. Investigators said the incident does not appear to be a random act of violence and remains under investigation. Before Bailey was identified, Davenport Community School District said in an email to the Quad City Times-Dispatch Argus the teen attended Mid-City High School. The district said it has called in its crisis response team and additional counseling for Mid-City's student and staff. Those resources will be available throughout the week. District staff are working with law enforcement. Anyone with information is asked to call Davenport Police Department at 563-326-6125. Again, that number is 563-326-6125. Or submit an anonymous tip to QC Crime Stoppers by visiting www.qccrimestoppers.com or downloading the Page 3 Tips app.
Okay, and we've got some pictures here on our front page of the local section, Exploring Family Museum. This refers to the Family Museum in Bettendorf. And the picture shows a little boy. It says, as soon as Augie Nobis, 3, entered the Family Museum, he excitedly ran over to the Play Fire Station to throw on a mini pair of firefighter's boots and jacket on Tuesday, March 5th in Bettendorf. Nobis' mother explained that this was his favorite play area at the museum and will often spend most of his time there. And there's also a picture of two toddlers, Winnie Brock and Liam Long. They play in the kitchen at the Family Museum in Bettendorf on Tuesday. The Family Museum gives babies, toddlers, and kids room to explore and play in a safe environment. And finally, one other picture of a toddler collecting eggs from the play chicken coop at George's Farm within the Family Museum on Tuesday, March 5th in Bettendorf. The museum teaches kids where their food is produced on a farm. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we're going to turn to the obituaries. First up with Paul Francis Celine. Was born September 11th, 1951, the second of seven children born to Tenny and Lorena Doak Celine. He was proud to have been born in Faith, South Dakota, near the ranch where his mother grew up. He spent the first 8 years in Oaklawn, Illinois, after which the family moved to Davenport. Summers were spent working on his cousin's farm in Upper Michigan and riding horses in South Dakota. After graduating from Davenport West High School in 1970, he joined the Air Force. He served in Texas, Wyoming, and Okinawa, where he studied Japanese and cultivated a lifelong interest in Japanese culture. Upon returning to the States in 1975, he earned a bachelor's degree in English and a master's degree in education from the University of Iowa. He married Rhonda Rath in 1979. Paul started teaching high school English in Hot Springs, South Dakota. Paul and Rhonda welcomed their son Eric in 1983. Wanting to be closer to family, they moved to Central Illinois in 1987, and Paul taught at Olympia High School in Stanford, Illinois for the next 25 years. At school, he was the yearbook and newspaper advisor, co-taught an innovative program combining English, the environment, and technology, and later chaired the language department. He was a National Board Certified Teacher, and he earned the Illinois Master Teacher Certification. During these years, he cultivated many hobbies, including gardening, birding, hiking, reading, writing, biking, photography, and cooking. He served as Eric's Club Scout Leader, coached Eric's baseball team, and took Eric camping. Newly single, Paul met his partner, Sue Pia, at a writing workshop and later moved to her home in Oak Park, Illinois. In 2020, he published a book of his essays and poems. Diagnosed with dementia in 2019, Paul coped with a devastating diagnosis as well as anyone could. Age 72, he died Wednesday, February 28th. In addition to Eric and Sue, Paul is survived by his siblings, Don, Julie Farmer, Lynn Palmer, Malcolm, and Phil, Aunt Betty Krause, and cousins, nieces, nephews, and friends. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, March 16th at the Bloomington, Illinois Unitarian Universalist Church, 1613 East Emerson Street in Bloomington, Illinois, at 1 p.m. and available on Zoom. Donations in Paul's honor may be made to Olympia High School English Department. Mary E. Earp, of Bettendorf was 88 and died on Monday, March 4th at Genesis Medical Center, East Campus in Davenport. A service to celebrate her life will be held at 4 p.m. on Friday, March 8th at Asbury United Methodist Church of Bettendorf, where she was a member. The family will greet friends from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. on Friday at the church. Memorials may be made to Asbury United Methodist Church. McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home of Bettendorf is assisting the family with arrangements. Mary was born in Quincy, Illinois on August 9, 1935, the daughter of Ben and Laura Thornton Bodecker. She was united in marriage to Eugene E. Earp in Sutter, Illinois on December 18, 1955. She was a graduate of Hamilton, Illinois High School and a 1956 graduate of the former Galesburg School of Nursing. Mary was employed as a registered nurse at the former St. Luke's Hospital in Davenport for 16 years and later at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, retiring in 1994. Mary enjoyed spending time with her family and friends and loved reading and dancing. Those left to honor her memory include her husband, Gene, her daughter, Penny Stanley of Roanoke, Virginia, her son, Timothy Earp of Des Moines, her grandchildren, Nathan Earp and Erica Earp, her great-grandchildren, Colin and Sarah, her step-great-grandchildren, Patrick House and Catherine Leto, and her step-great-great-granddaughter, Mava. She was preceded in death by her brothers, Gerald Bodecker and Louis Bodecker, and her parents. Condolences may be expressed to the family by viewing their obituary at www.mcginnischambers.com.
Continuing, Tracy Poston Matthews, June 1, 1969, March 5, 2024. Creative, talented, beautiful to describe the incomparable Tracy Poston Matthews. Tracy died peacefully on Tuesday, March 5th, after her most courageous battle with cancer. Her illness did not win, but rather Tracy chose to be an angel and loving guardian from above all of the people she loves. Born on June 1, 1969 in Davenport, Tracy was the oldest of four sisters, whom were also some of her best friends. Her joys were pure. She loved the sun in her face, baking, sitting poolside with friends, making arts and crafts, listening to 70s music, enjoying a fruity cocktail, and her truest joy of all, being with her husband and children. Tracy had a lifelong passion for music and graduated from Cornell College with a double major in music and elementary education. She began her teaching career at Mount Vernon Elementary School as a fourth grade teacher and spent the next 32 years as a beloved elementary school teacher within the Davenport Community School District. Tracy was committed to being the best teacher she could be. In that pursuit, she achieved her master's degree from Drake University. She was the one always encouraging her students to dance and sing, to play instruments, to make learning fun, and to see classrooms as a place where kids wanted to be. There is not a single student who didn't love Mrs. Matthews with all of their heart. Tracy married her high school sweetheart, Manny Matthews, on June 27, 1992. Manny was her one and only, and she his. Their love for each other was intense, only dwarfed by the love embodied for their children, Michael and Ellie. The four of them were known for family productions with Tracy at the piano, with Manny at the guitar, and their children's beautiful voices providing the vocals. Tracy's world revolved around her family, including the whole Carlin clan, the Postons, the Volantes, and the Longneckers, Yia, and numerous close friends, all of whom she considered family. Tracy's world was always enriched by friends and co-workers, and once her friend, always her friend. This is evident in the length of her friendships, having so many from elementary school all the way through college and beyond. Always with a smile on her face, to know Tracy was to love Tracy. The members of her fan club include the teachers and administrators she worked with, neighbors, friends, and friends of friends, and the list goes on. Tracy's life will be celebrated at Helican McCabe DeVries Funeral Home on Saturday, March 9th from 2 to 5 p.m. with a brief prayer shared at 4:30 p.m. In true Tracy spirit, feel free to wear your favorite 70s outfit, as she has requested a disco ball, 70s music, and the sharing of stories with laughter and love at her celebration. Tracy is survived by her husband Manny, children Michael and Ellie, parents Bev, husband Jim Marty, and Terry Poston, sisters Shelley, husband Tom Lynham, Nicole Hagen, and Natalie Poston, stepsister Chris, husband Mike Vieger, stepbrother Brian, wife Kelly Marty, mother-in-law Nancy Matthews, sisters-in-law Maria, husband Dave Vellante, and Georgette, husband Ted Longnecker, as well as many loving aunts, uncles, cousins, nieces, nephews, in-laws, and many other family friends. The family would like to thank the entire University of Iowa Healthcare Oncology team, the wonderful staff at Clarissa Cook Hospice, and Dr. Stephen Aguilar. In lieu of flowers, the family has requested donations made to the Eisenhower Elementary School PTA. Checks can be made payable to Eisenhower PTA or through Venmo at Eisenhower-PTA. Creative, talented, beautiful, and loving. That is our Tracy. In Davenport, Charlotte Marie Carr Evans, September 25, 1957 to March 6, 2024. Charlotte Marie Carr Evans, 66, of Davenport, Iowa, passed away peacefully on March 6, 2024, surrounded by loved ones after a courageous battle with leukemia. A devoted wife, mother, Mimi, sister, and friend, she will be deeply missed. Born September 25, 1957, in Liberal, Kansas, to Willard Henry and Lilla Moreland Carr, Charlotte graduated from Liberal High School in 1975. While attending the University of Tulsa, she met her future husband, Jeff. Recognizing they were meant to be, Jeff sooner than Charlotte, they were married June 18, 1977. Charlotte transferred to Marycrest College, earning her Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 1980. Her dedication to learning continued with a Master of Science in Nursing from St. Ambrose University in 2007. Charlotte's 40-year nursing career at Genesis Health System was marked by passion and excellence. Recognized for her outstanding care, she received the 100 Great Nurses Award in 2013 and the Jennison Legend Award in 2018. She retired as the Chief Nursing Officer at Genesis in August of 2020. Charlotte cherished spending time with the family and friends. Her hobbies included traveling, plants, bird watching, playing cards, and cooking and baking. She especially enjoyed being a part of every aspect of her grandchildren's lives. Charlotte is survived by her husband Jeff Evans, daughter Jennifer, Brian Vitti Smith, son Justin, wife Amy Evans, grandchildren Evan and Lilla Smith and Cole and Mason Fisher, brothers Dennis, wife Tammy Carr, and Scott, wife Lori Carr, and numerous beloved nieces and nephews and extended family. Preceding her in death are her parents, brothers Trent and Rodney Carr. Visitation will be held on Friday, March 8th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. The funeral will be held on Saturday, March 9th at 10 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Genesis Health System Foundation for future nurses. Online condolences may be left at www.hmdfuneralhome.com.
Okay, now we're going to turn to the opinion section, and we'll start with the column Another View, which is out of the Chicago Tribune. Court liberals help Trump and America. Unanimous ruling returning former president to ballot knocks down deep state claims. We were not surprised that the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday ruled that individual states can't unilaterally bar former President Donald Trump from appearing on ballots on the grounds of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the part of the Constitution that bars prior insurrectionists from holding office. When it comes to federal offices, it's pretty clear that the framers saw the application or disabling of that amendment as the responsibility of Congress. States certainly have the authority to bar their own state officials on those grounds, which is well and good. But having some states allow Trump's name to stand on a ballot for President of the United States and others bar him on a patchwork basis clearly would have produced a chaotic result, given that what happens in one state would, of course, impact the other 49. And any reasonable person can see that partisan tit-for-tats would have been the inevitable consequence. This was always a Hail Mary on the part of those who believe that Trump's odious actions on that rightly notorious January 6th were those of an insurrectionist and thus disqualifying in his current presidential run. Illinois was among the states that gave it a shot, most of those who supported this attempt, and we were never among them, likely had convinced themselves that the end justified their means. Tempting, but no cigar. But we were stirred and pleased that the Supremes acted unanimously in striking down the Colorado Supreme Court ruling, which was the issue on the table here, but will extend to other states that have followed suit. The three liberal justices stepped away from their potential partisan corners and also rejected the suggestions of several law professors, no doubt of their acquaintance. That puts this issue to bed in the best possible way, and Trump should return the favor by noting that not everything in Washington is some deep state plot against him. To his credit, he actually did take some baby steps Monday in that direction. When things go his way, he is capable of marginal magnanimity. It's when things do not that this big baby's ruinous side always reveals itself. In this case, he could learn a thing or two from those liberal justices. They swallowed hard and did their jobs. Trump for president is a matter for the voters, such as the price of democracy.
The rush to accuse Israel of genocide is wrong. This is by Jonah Goldberg, who is the editor-in-chief of The Dispatch, thedispatch.com. If I were a Palestinian struggling amid the rubble in Gaza, I would probably think Israel is committing genocide. If I were a German hiding in Dresden or a Japanese civilian outside Hiroshima in 1945, I'd probably feel the same way about the United States. But none of those amount to genocide. Genocide has a specific definition: the deliberate and systematic extermination of a national, racial, political, or cultural group. The term was coined by Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jew, in response to Winston Churchill's observation about the Holocaust. Quote, we are in the presence of a crime without a name, end quote. In fairness, images of war, particularly of this war, can seem to indicate genocide. But in Gaza, this stems in no small part from Hamas's strategy. They cannot win and will not fight a conventional war. Palestinian civilians don't get bomb shelters. Only Hamas fighters do. The point remains, if supposedly all-powerful Israel has been bent on genocide, it's oddly bad at it. According to the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics, the Palestinian population has grown more than eightfold since Israel's founding, while the population of Gaza Strip has increased 600% since 1960. So maybe genocide was never Israel's intent in the first place? Of course, you can't say the same about Hamas and Hezbollah. They're open about their goal of eliminating Israel. Even denunciation of Israel often undermine the genocide claim Israel is condemned for inadequate warnings about attacks and insufficient humanitarian support to Gaza. But if genocide were the aim, why drop warning leaflets or provide aid at all? Alas, it's a sign of the times that absolving Israel of Hitlerite genocide counts as an outrageous defense of Israel. It's a bit like when I tell some of my fellow Trump critics that Donald Trump isn't Hitler, and they react like I'm rushing to his defense. There's plenty to criticize Israel about without resorting to genocide accusations, and plenty of very negative labels can be arguably used to criticize Israel's action in Gaza: inhumane, excessive, wanton, without mischaracterizing intent. The claim that Israel's policy toward Palestinians is racist and genocidal is very old, with deep roots in Soviet propaganda along with Holocaust denial. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader in the West Bank, wrote his doctoral dissertation on this garbage at Moscow's Patrice Lumumba University. Vladimir Putin, whose war against Ukraine does fit the UN's definition of genocide, and has revived this tactic to distract and divide the West. Politicians, pundits, and activists routinely accuse Israel of genocide. Loose assertions of genocide have consequences, none good. First, genocide is one of those concepts that psychologically arouses a sense of total moral authority in its opponents. Any form of resistance can be justified, which is why so many people have bent over backwards to justify or contextualize the horror of Hamas' October 7th attack. Second, this mindset fosters collective guilt. Jews around the world, regardless of their attitudes toward Israel or Zionism, are being targeted for abuse and discrimination simply for their alleged complicity in genocide. Many extremists subscribe to a moral tautology that says Israel is like Nazi Germany, and therefore if you support Israel, you're akin to a Nazi. Since Jews support Israel, Jews or Zionists are fair game for all manner of harassment and exclusion. Finally, if Israel is going to be accused of genocide, regardless of its actions, it has that much less incentive to show restraint in its efforts to defeat an enemy that is actually genocidal. Indeed, those most loudly calling for a ceasefire to stop Israeli genocide often fall short of demanding that Hamas surrender. That would stop the genocide, bloodshed, by any name tomorrow. But apparently, that's a bridge too far for those outraged by genocide.
And our final article here in the opinion section is by Jerry Davich. The bald truth about hair, horseshoes, shaved heads. The young schoolboy blurted out his first impression when I entered his classroom. "I like your hair," he exclaimed. I had no idea why he said this until a few seconds later. "My dad is bald," he said with a sigh. A few of his classmates giggled. I scribbled down his unsolicited observation for this column, which has been bouncing around my hairy head for nearly a month. Men's baldness is a topic I've never put much thought into. I recently learned why. I've been blessed to have a head of hair that grows like a chia pet submerged in holy water. I need a haircut every 3 to 4 weeks. Otherwise, I begin looking like that guy who has wild and crazy hair but doesn't know it. You know the guys I'm talking about. But bald? It never occurred to me what bald men go through, physically or psychologically. As soon as this topic landed on my radar, I began asking around to men with bald or shaved heads. Are they bald by choice or by genetics? How do they feel about it? "Bald is beautiful, baby," a work colleague told me. He was just talking to his barber about hair restoration promises, he said. I don't believe they're effective, despite the marketing, so why throw my money away this might work, he said. I'm not vain enough to really care about something as silly as being bald. Not all bald men described it to me as something silly, though a few deflected my questions with jokes such as, "What do you call a bald man on a windy day?" for fortunate. Larry David, the writer, actor, and comedian, doesn't feel as fortunate. When he accepted his Emmy Award in 1992 for outstanding writing in a comedy series for the classic Seinfeld episode, The Contest, he quipped, "This is all very well and good, but I'm still bald." Obviously, it doesn't bother him enough to get his hair restored like other high-profile celebrities, such as TV sports announcer Joe Buck, who's undergone 8 and counting hair plug procedures. His addiction to these procedures cost him his voice for part of the 2011 season, caused by a side effect of a hair transplant. A few years ago, just before I met former Chicago Bears superstar Brian Urlacher at a casino, a few co-workers reminded me to check out his newly restored hair. I did everything I could to not stare at it while interviewing him, but I heard other people whispering about it. In the Chicago region near where I live, dozens of billboards are still posted near major highways showing images of Urlacher's new head of hair, compliments of RestoreHair.com. One states, "Welcome to O'Hare, H-I-H-A-I-R, Hairport." Others state, "Hairlacher and Hall of Fame Hair and Urlacher 1, Balding 0. A work colleague of mine who sports a shaved head offers a more philosophical approach. If my memory of studying evolution is accurate, human beings become less hairy as they advanced through the ages. So bald men are more evolved than men with great hair, it would seem, he said, noting that he's pretending to look like an NBA star rather than merely an old guy. Charles Barkley, the former NBA superstar, who's as bald as a basketball, recently said nobody wants to be bald. "Everybody I know who's bald, we started going bald," he said. "We didn't want to go bald, we just started balding." Male pattern baldness matters more than I thought. The phrase hair restoration is often uttered in the same hushed tone as erectile dysfunction. To avoid it, most bald men I know intentionally keep their head shaved as a preemptive strike against the appearance of natural balding. "I never cared enough to do any treatments, and I never wanted to go through the reapplying of the products," one friend told me. "I shave by choice every day," another friend said. "I saw my dad's horseshoe on his head and promised myself I would never have that." "I had no idea so many of my friends are bald. I guess I just didn't notice." "I'm banking on artificial intelligence to someday restore my hair and rescue my love life," a social media friend told me. Another friend said he and four friends shaved their heads for the last day of high school. One friend used Nair and got a horrible rash. Another friend used a razor and had cuts everywhere. Another had a really lumpy head, he recalled. "Mine, on the other hand, just looked good, so I kept it. I used a razor that day and still do this today. I knew I had thin hair and my day would come. Imagine all the money saved on shampoo over the years." Barkley disagrees. "Everybody wants hair," he said. And again, that was written by Jerry Davich, who writes for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we're going to turn to the sports section and see what there is to watch on TV. We have the Iowa Hawkeyes at the Big Ten tournament. That starts on Friday. And let's see if there's anything. Here we go. Today, in women's basketball, we've got Maryland versus Illinois Fighting Illini at 11:30 a.m. today. You know, that's not telling me a channel. Let me look down here. Here we go. All right, sorry about that. So we've got the Big Ten, Wisconsin versus whoever wins in one of the other games at 11:30 to 2:30. Nope, I think these are the different times for the Big Ten tournament. Excuse me. We have an 11:30 game, a 2:30 game, and an 8 o'clock game. That's in the Big Ten tournament on BTN today. Also, in the Big Ten tournament, we've got Wisconsin versus Penn State at 5:30 on BTN. The Pac-12 tournament is on Pac-12 Network at 2:35 and 7:30. You can catch golf this afternoon, the PGA Tour, Arnold Palmer Invitation on the Golf Network. In the NBA this evening on TNT at 6:30, you've got Miami at Douglas. At 9 o'clock, you've got Chicago at Golden State on NBC SCH. And also at 9 o'clock on TNT, you've got Boston at Denver. In the NHL at 6 this evening on ESPN, we have St. Louis at New Jersey. And you can catch a spring training game at 7 o'clock on MLB Network, Chicago Cubs versus Cincinnati. And we've got some Champions Cup games in soccer this evening on FS2. The R16 Leg 1, Monterey at Cincinnati, and R16 Leg 1 at 8 o'clock, Miami at Nashville. And again, that was on FS2. Let's see if we have any short articles here. Cyclones finish unbeaten at home in Ames. Taman Lipsey scored 19 points and Curtis Jones added 18 to help number 6 Iowa State finish the season undefeated at home for the first time in 23 years with a 68-63 win over number 20 Brigham Young on Wednesday night. The Cyclones, whose record is 24-6, 13-4 in the Big 12, completed their home schedule 18-0 and remained within a game of conference leader Houston heading into the final weekend. The Cyclones needed a win to stay in the hunt for a share of the Big 12 title and to lock down the number 2 seed in next week's conference tournament in Kansas City. BYU was picked in the preseason to finish 13th in the Big 12, but began this week with a chance to earn a top 4 seed in the tourney. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.